A lot of the arguments that were used against gay and lesbian communities in the 50s and 60s are now being recycled against trans people. What I really try to always do in my shows is ask audiences, why am I only safe when I'm entertaining you? Why can't I look like this just next to you on the subway or walking down the street? Why do you see this as a costume and not what you're wearing as a costume? It's an attempt and a desire to disappear us so we can maintain the myth that there are just two genders, man and woman.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Thai king gives royal assent to marriage equality, Russian lawmakers ban adoptions to pro-queer countries, and a look challenges the gender masquerade. Those stories and more this week because you've unmasked This Way Out.
I'm David Hunt.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending September 28, 2024. Marriage in Thailand will now be defined as a legal union of two individuals. King Maha Vajiralongkorn made it official on September 24th with his royal assent to a bill amending the country's civil and commercial code. It won approval in the Senate in June by a lopsided vote of 130 to 4. The previous definition of civil marriage referred to the parties as a man and a woman, or a husband and wife. Adoption and inheritance rights are included in the legislation. It takes effect 120 days from the king's signature and the publication of his assent in the Royal Gazette. Thailand is now the first Southeast Asian country to achieve marriage equality. Despite its global reputation for being queer-friendly, the struggle has been arduous. Activist Siritata Ninlaprook told Agence France-Presse, "We've been fighting for our rights for over 10 years, and now it's finally happening." Same-gender couples will be able to walk down the aisle for the first time on January 22, 2025. Bangkok Pride is organizing a mass wedding ceremony for queer couples on the big day.
The Duma has given initial approval to a ban on the adoption of Russian children to countries where gender-affirming healthcare is practiced. Speaker Vyacheslav Volodin proclaimed, "We are doing everything for the child not to end up in a country where same-sex marriage and sex change is allowed." The measure bars adoptive parents from countries that approve the change of sex by medical intervention, including with the use of medicine. Countries that allow trans people to change their legal gender on government documents are also prohibited. The vote in the first reading was 397 to 1. Two more readings and passage by the upper house of Russia's legislature are required before Vladimir Putin can sign it into law. His war on Ukraine has complicated the adoption process by making it close to impossible for prospective foreign parents to travel to Russia. Putin might also want to deflect attention from the thousands of Ukrainian children that have been illegally siphoned into Russian foster care.
Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton is on the warpath against another Biden administration queer-supportive policy. This time, the far-right Republican is suing over a requirement that foster care agencies equip prospective families to support a child's potential LGBTQ+ identity. The Department of Health and Human Services guidelines were issued on April 30th and took effect on July 1st. They flatly state all foster care placements must be safe and appropriate for all children, including LGBTQI+ children. The guidelines also protect children from being forcibly outed to prospective parents or staff at foster care agencies. The infamously anti-queer Paxton is arguing that the guidelines unconstitutionally violate his state's sovereignty. Texas bans pediatric gender-affirming health care and has other repressive anti-trans laws. Paxton also complains that the additional costs of compliance threaten substantial economic injury to Texas. He's asking the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Texas for a permanent injunction against implementation of the guidelines and for monetary damages.
A leading free expression advocate reports this week that more than 10,000 books were banned in U.S. public schools during the 2023-2024 academic year. That's more than triple the nearly 3,400 books PEN America said were removed from public school libraries during the previous academic year. The group released its initial results on September 23rd to kick off Banned Books Week. PEN America specifically blames bans passed in Republican-controlled state legislatures like Iowa, Florida, Utah, South Carolina, and Tennessee under the guise of parental rights. In the words of their press release, the stark increase includes books featuring romance, books about women's sexual experiences, and books about rape or sexual abuse, as well as continued attacks on books with LGBTQ plus characters or themes, or books about race or racism and featuring characters of color. The book banning fever is starting to engulf some surprising mainstream titles, along with the usual queer-related suspects like Alice Walker's The Color Purple, Mike Curato's Flamer, and Justin Richardson, Peter Parnell, and Henry Cole's And Tango Makes Three. Students are no longer supposed to study Alex Haley's seminal Roots, The Saga of an American Family. Agatha Christie's Death on the Nile has been thrown overboard, along with Terry McMillan's How Stella Got Her Groove Back. For some reason, it took the censors until this round to catch iconic queer black writer James Baldwin's semi-autobiographical Go Tell It on the Mountain. PEN America promises that a final count and a more detailed analysis into the rationales behind particular objections is forthcoming. The PEN America release concludes, book bans impede the freedom to read, limiting students' access to diversity of views and stories.
The Federal Bureau of Investigation's annual Crime in the Nation report reveals a major increase in hate crimes in the United States in 2023, particularly those targeting LGBTQ plus people. More than 1 in 5 hate crimes were motivated by anti-queer animus. This week's report counts more than 2,400 hate incidents based on sexual orientation. That's an increase of more than 500 cases over the previous year. More than 400 incidents were based on gender identity or expression, and an additional 146 incidents targeted gender nonconforming people. Keep in mind that far more anti-queer hate crimes go unreported. The rise in hate crimes runs counter to a significant drop in crime overall during the presidency of Joe Biden. The Human Rights Campaign contributed research to the report. The queer advocacy group pointed to the disproportionate number of hate crimes targeting transgender women of color, especially black people and immigrants. HRC officially declared a state of emergency for the queer community last year. In a statement released this week, President Kelly Robinson challenged government officials to, in her words, stop lying about our community and inciting hatred against us, and called for comprehensive anti-bias protections. To PFLAG's Brian K. Bond, the FBI report was abysmal. The Queer Ally Group's CEO said, "Our LGBTQ plus loved ones need both our compassion and our action to make our community safe and our laws inclusive, so every LGBTQ plus person can be safe, celebrated, affirmed, and loved everywhere in the U.S.
Finally, a study published this week in the scientific journal Nature Human Behavior is no surprise. In the words of Vice President of Research Renita Naff of the Youth Suicide Prevention Group, the Trevor Project, it offers robust and indisputable evidence to support what we have already known. The recent wave of anti-transgender laws in the United States is quite literally risking the lives of young people across the country. The report is based on new peer-reviewed research by the Trevor Project. It tracked self-reported suicide attempts by young people from 13 to 17 years of age across multiple years. The rate of attempted suicide increased by up to 72% following the passage of an anti-trans law in a respondent's home state. Bullying also played a role in those attempted suicides, which also led to increased substance abuse and missed school days. State laws weighing on trans youth include school sports bans, campus bathroom and changing room requirements, and severe restrictions or total prohibitions on pediatric gender-affirming healthcare. Trevor Project CEO James Black's press statement reads in part, "As we get closer to critical elections this November, these young people will continue to be reduced to political talking points. I urge every adult, no matter your political beliefs, to remember that transgender and non-binary young people are our family, our friends, and our neighbors. It's not necessary to fully understand their experience to acknowledge that they, like all young people, deserve dignity, respect, and the ability to lead healthy and full lives."
That's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending September 28th, 2024. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappelle, produced by Brian Schaeser, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm David Hunt. Stay healthy.
And I'm Michael LeBeau. Stay safe.
Hi, this is John Cameron Mitchell, the writer-director of Hedwig the Angry Inch and Short Bus, and you're listening to This Way Out, the international weekly radio magazine for all our sexually diverse communities.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
Smashing the gender binary is a revolutionary act that opens up a whole new perspective on liberation politics. This Way Out's Brian DeShazer picked up on the fact that that new train of thought is rich with the echoes of a forward-thinking queer philosopher activist of the 1990s.
A few years ago, I watched an episode of Getting Curious with Jonathan Van Ness on Netflix and discovered the charismatic Alok, an incredible non-binary gender non-conforming artist. I was instantly captivated and have followed their journey ever since. Earlier this year, I learned that Alok is the nibbling of LGBT activist Urvashi Vaid, a frequent guest on This Way Out back in the 1990s. I sent Alok some classic recordings and invited them to join us on the show. That invitation led to an incredible conversation this past July. For those who don't know, Alok, they, them, is an internationally acclaimed poet, comedian, speaker, and actor. They've published works like Beyond the Gender Binary and Femme in Public, and have performed in over 40 countries, including shows at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival and the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. Alok's work offers an accessible introduction to gender fluidity, showing us how moving beyond the binary creates freedom for everyone. Next, we talk about their book, Beyond the Gender Binary, which challenges the world to see gender not in black and white, but in full color. Taking from their own experiences as gender non-conforming artists, they show us that gender is a malleable and creative form of expression.
What I found is that the majority of people support trans rights. They just don't have the arguments on why. And so I wanted to create a really accessible handbook that people could consult with the sort of leading debates around trans issues and trans rights and potential rebuttals. So what we're seeing, unfortunately, across the world is, as we've seen progress for gay, lesbian, and bi rights, there's been a backlash taken out in the form of specifically trans rights. And a lot of the arguments that were used against gay and lesbian communities in the 50s and 60s are now being recycled and reworkshopped to be deputized against trans people. So in the handbook, I sort of offer some of the common arguments that are used against us and what we could say back.
Right. So that first one, and actually in the beginning, you really talk about beauty and fear and your experience just being you, and how does that empower you?
It's quite ridiculous because there's a way in which conservative forces have made people feel like trans people have access to some kind of mythological power or cultural influence, when many of us actually can't leave our homes without very real risk of physical violence and intense persecution. There are very few places in the world that I can safely express myself, and I'm constantly having to navigate physical safety even in 2024. And what I notice, and a lot of what inspired me to write that book, is that it's often the days that I am most myself that I'm most in danger. And so there's a way in which we tell people to be themselves, but we don't actually create the mechanisms to protect them when they are. And that we live in a country and a culture that punishes people for their authentic self-expression. So what that looks like for me is, you know, if I decide to wear a dress, or if I decide to wear makeup, or things that are associated with femininity that people see as dissonant or incongruent with my quote unquote masculine body, then people feel threatened or intimidated by that. And violence becomes a corrective where they're trying to intimidate me into being back into the binary. So what I read a lot of the harassment against gender nonconforming people as is an attempt and a desire to disappear us so we can maintain the myth that there are just two genders, man and woman.
And what is that like? You know, that book was written 4 years ago, and now you've traveled, let's just say 20 cities so far in your world tour. How does that affect you now in terms of that the safe place when you are traveling internationally? How has that changed for you from 2020 when you wrote the book till now, or has it?
You know, I think what's hard is that a lot of people consume queer people's content, like we're fabulous and spectacular, and we are, but we're also in danger. So what's important to name is I can sell at a venue and then be called a faggot on the street right after. That happened to me twice on this most recent tour. And when we think about like our favorite pop divas, if that was happening to white cisgender straight women, we would think that's a real issue. That's a crisis. How dare you? But we've become so accustomed and normalized to the routine homophobia and transphobia that we're only acceptable with queer expression when it's on a stage. And even that's coming under attack with these recent anti-drag laws, which are also trying to criminalize gender nonconformity in a performance context. So what I really try to always do in my shows is ask audiences, why am I only safe when I'm entertaining you? Why can't I look like this just next to you on the subway or walking down the street? Why do you see this as a costume and not what you're wearing as a costume? If you're going to say that I'm masquerading as something, so too are you. You know, often we hear, you're valid, but I can't remember your pronouns, that's too complicated. Or your preferred name is too much, too hard for me to recall. I see you as what I named you when you were born. And people's discomfort is taken as equivalent to oppression. And so what that's resulted in is profound suicidality, depression, mental illness, and many LGBT and especially trans and gender nonconforming communities, because we're constantly made to feel like our very existence is an inconvenience. And what I've always believed is that we put in the time for the things that we care about. So people use this idea of comprehension, I don't get it, or it's too complex, as a shield to not name a deeper truth, which is I don't care. And I think that's what we receive on the other side is when people say things to us like, this is too much, what we read is you just don't care because you put in the time to learn the things that you care about. You know about all the different kinds of cars. You know about the differences between different vacuum cleaners. You find things that you're passionate about and then you get curious about them. But when it comes to trans and gender nonconforming people, you think that we're just some sort of self-indulgent, attention-seeking, wanting to be oppressed phenomenon, which once what I want really want people to understand is that that's a manufactured narrative that's been created specifically as part of sanctioning discrimination against us. So while most people think that we're crybabies, murder, violence, homelessness, criminalization against our communities is escalating. So one of the things I was thinking about, especially in preparing for this conversation and listening to some of the recordings of my late aunt Rishi Vaid, she spoke a lot about this concept, virtual equality, which is one of the books that she wrote. And part of, I think, the new tendril of virtual equality is also virtual acceptance. There's been a mirage of, oh, we're an LGBTQ progressive society, but that's just a narrative or a discourse that hasn't actually mapped into the lived experiences of LGBTQ people. We still don't have domestic violence shelters that are tuned to the specifics of our relationship configurations. We have no plans for our LGBTQ elders. We're often dealing with extreme poverty and alienation. There's so much infrastructure we haven't built, and yet people think that we're equal.
Visibility is the key to success of the lesbian and gay movements for civil rights protections. Hi, I'm Urvashi Vaid, inviting you to listen to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine, one of our most visible and articulate voices for our lesbian and gay communities.
That was Urvashi Vaid, a look's aunt. Next, we will play a clip of Urvashi from 1995, interviewed by Josie Cotoggio for This Way Out. Lucia Chappelle gives the introduction.
Former executive director of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, Urvashi Vaid, has just come out with a new book. Virtual Equality, the Mainstreaming of Gay and Lesbian Liberation, examines how the strategies of the movement have brought us so far in some ways and yet gained us so little in others. At the same time I was doing all this work, I was, you know, getting more and more involved in gay and lesbian organizations. And I brought this intellectual and kind of political commitment to social change and social justice into my movement work. The thing is that the gay movement has always been, I guess we've been split, or there's a tension in the movement between folks who see the role of a gay movement as in a narrow, narrow sense, and those of us who come from many other movements for social change and see that the gay movement has to be part of a broader process of changing society to make it more democratic for all people.
Well, that was Urvashi Vaid from an interview from November 20th, 1995 on This Way Out. And yeah, it doesn't seem like much has changed, has it?
No, unfortunately. I was thinking the same thing while I was listening to her recordings. Her words are oddly prophetic to describe our current condition.
And also, yeah, when I think about what they must have been talking about in terms of who the people were in Congress, the cast has changed. And yet we're still talking about the same actions against us, you know, anti-trans, anti-queer, more so than ever before. Even as you've been traveling the world, what has been the international response or feedback that you've gotten about the American paradigm right now?
There's been a profound reconciliation where people are now seeing that the U.S. has been a really great broadcasting and marketing project, saying that it's this LGBTQ safe haven, and people are waking up to that collective spell that it's not. There's a lot of conversations of like, Tennessee, are you kidding me? Florida, what's going on? People are profoundly alarmed and disenchanted and disillusioned with the United States. There's also a frustration because a lot of the techniques and strategies of the anti-LGBTQ movement in the US are being globalized and disseminated across the world right now. So a key staple in these far-right and authoritarian regimes is anti-LGBTQ politics. And that playbook is being created in places like Florida and then disseminated across the world. So these people don't see the US as something over there, woe is me. They're also paying attention because they're seeing the exact same rhetoric. I was recently on a call with some trans activists from Pakistan, and they were telling me that in their Supreme Court rulings, a lot of the conservative forces there are citing U.S. policymakers and U.S. cultural makers around anti-transness. And when they say, hey, actually, we have documentation of thousands of years of history of gender fluidity within the Pakistani context, that doesn't matter, because now what's happening is this idea that being trans or non-binary is this newfangled millennial internet phenomenon, which is once again a manufactured narrative. That's becoming the predominant narrative globally.
Wow. So disheartening. And yet I'm still so enlivened by what the movement may be or what it can be. I just hope that there's a quicker response. Another thing I was thinking too is like, you know, for decades, it was always about people coming from other countries to America for safe haven, whether Nigeria, Ugandans, people where there's countries that are seriously in danger. I mean, immigrating into America. And now I feel like I need a place to go if the tables turn.
I think you're totally right. And I feel frustrated because especially revisiting these interviews with Orvish from 20, 30, 40 years ago, what she was really clearly arguing is that the more progressive wing of the LGBTQ movement was fighting for total and fundamental freedom. And because decisions were made not for the progressive wing of the movement to be the predominant strain, that's why we're in this situation. We're in this situation precisely because of our assimilationist bent in our movement that said, we're just like you, that said, we're not trying to ruffle any feathers. That's how we got to this situation where we can see the exact same rhetoric that was used against our communities 70 years ago have so much traction and pull. So because we moved from a place of fear and inadequacy, a place of pick me, that's where partially why we're in this situation now. And I feel like so often the work of lesbians, of trans people, of people of color gets dismissed as minoritarian, as of like full of fractions or divisive. But actually these frameworks create more total and fundamental freedom for an entire society. Had the queer movement actually continued to seek alliances with broader movements for social and economic progress and change, we would have built the coalitions that could actually sustain the kind of safety that we're looking for now. But instead, a decision to splinter off into really myopic issues, like just focusing on marriage at the expense of poverty, or focusing on gay adoption rights at the expense of overhauling our entire education system. These more fundamental and total politics that I think Orvishi was so interested in.
You've been listening to part one of our inspiring conversation with the incredible Aluk Vaad Menon. Please join us next week for the conclusion of our conversation with more historic audio of Orvishi Vaad. For This Way Out, I'm Brian DeShazer.
Thanks for finding This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. NewsWrap was reported this week by David Hunt and Michael LeBeau. NewsWrap and this week's feature were produced by Brian DeShazer with the assistance of Daniel Luisius. You heard music by James Cameron Mitchell, Tom Petty, and Julian Winter. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks to the Ivana Foundation and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Listener donors make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and the entire This Way Out crew, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and on WDRT Viroqua, Wisconsin, 5GTR Mount Gambier, South Australia, KPCA Petaluma, California, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned, y'all.